Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, join Shahina Ghazanfar, author and botanist at the Royal Botanic Gardens, Kew, and renowned scientific illustrator Sue Wickison, as they discuss their award-winning book and exhibition, Plants of the Curran. Recorded live at the 2024 Bradford Literature Festival, this is a captivating talk from the creators of the first book to investigate the etymology and history of the plants mentioned in the Curran.
Hello and welcome everybody. My name's Samia Rahman, I'm an author. So I am delighted to chair this session this afternoon on Plants of the Quran. We're joined today with Shahina Ghazanfar, an author and botanist at the Royal Botanic Gardens in Kew, and renowned scientific illustrator Sue Wickison in conversation as they discuss their award-winning book, Plants of the Quran. So this is the first book ever to investigate the etymology and history of the plants mentioned in the Quran. It gives descriptions and beautiful detailed illustrations showing the plants' habitats, leaves, flowers, fruits, and dissections. This book is the winner of the Garden Media Guild Award Book of the Year and the 2024 Award of Excellence in Botanical Art and illustration from the Council on Botanical and Horticultural Libraries. So this is a truly exquisite publication. It's also in exhibition form at the beautiful Cartwright Hall in Bradford, so please do check it out while it's still on. So a big welcome to our esteemed panel. I'm going to sort of facilitate a conversation. So if I can begin by asking you both to sort of reflect on the fact that you come from vastly different disciplines. And yet, despite these, you know, disciplines that don't seem to sort of have a lot of intersectionality, you've come together to produce this beautiful book and exhibition. So can you both speak about your journey to this point? What inspired you? Why did you come together to produce this beautiful book? Whoever would like to go first.
Thank you, Samia, and thank you very much. Salaam alaikum. Well, I mean, I think the journey that you mentioned really got me to investigate and to write about the Quranic or the plants that are there in the Quran. It's quite interesting. I was in Oman, the Sultanate of Oman, and there was a notion in the UAE to create a garden, a sort of a botanic garden. I am a botanist by profession, and my expertise is the Middle Eastern plants of the Middle East. I was invited over to give some sort of input on the plants that would grow in that kind of environment. And in that botanic garden, they wanted to create a Quranic garden, plants that are just mentioned or are relevant into the Quran. So they said, well, you know, invited me, come and have a look. And so I started to look at, I hadn't really read the Quran all that well, perhaps, as to what all the plants were. I mean, as Muslims, we are always told that olive is there, zaytun is always there, grape is always there. And I remember my mother always saying that, you know, you're eating pomegranate. It is the fruit of paradise, or fig. That is the fruits of paradise. So I had some notion about a few of the plants which are mentioned in the Quran. But to go a little bit more in detail, I started looking up. There was nothing there. There was no book as such which would give me a list or any information on the entirety of the plants. So I started to look at all the papers that were written, and there were several lists of plants. And I looked down these papers and the lists that were there. And being a botanist, I thought, this plant cannot be in Arabia at the time when the Quran was scribed. There must be some error there. People probably haven't got the name correct. I mean, the Arabic names are quite easy. So these are direct translations from the Arabic. Zaytun, Anab, Teen, Roman, you know, no problem at all to know what these plants are. But there are some names which are quite difficult and I couldn't trace, and probably some of them got it wrong. So I had to start my investigation from there. So that was my research objective, really, to start my investigation, to basically see what are all the plants. And then I met Sue.
So Sue, tell us about what inspired you to get involved.
Thank you for inviting me and thank you for being here. My approach to the chronic plants came from a slightly different angle, and it was following a visit to the Sheikh Zayed Grand Mosque in 2015. And what inspired me, apart from the mosque itself, is the botanical forms all over the floors, all over the columns. And so it's just absolutely fascinating. It's an incredible place to visit, and you know, obviously very calm and peaceful and extraordinary place. And so I started to make some inquiries about the plants and what were they, and were they the plants in the Quran, or where were they from, and what were they depicting? And so my background is I'm trained as a scientific illustrator, and then worked at Kew Gardens for 9 years in the herbarium there, working on different plants. And so I contacted a colleague and said, could you put me in touch with, you know, somebody who was familiar with Middle Eastern plants, and you know, to find out what these plants actually were that were depicted in the mosque. And so unbeknownst to Dr. Gwilym Lewis, he didn't realize that Shahina was actually had been researching and was, you know, creating the writing for the book. And so he put us both together and introduced me. So it was very much a point of serendipity. And so an incredible journey then started to work with hand in hand with Shahina, you know, to find out what the plants are, and you know, always working very closely with Shahina on the lists. And this took me into Oman, into the UAE, to find the plants, and then always, you know, working back with Shahina to make sure I actually had the right plant to begin with. So both from like Q background, scientific illustration, but my inspiration was the Grand Mosque in Abu Dhabi. So that's where it started for me, and then the serendipitous meeting with Shahina.
I mean, Shahina mentioned being very sort of, you know, having the plants of the Quran sort of mentioned in her childhood. And Sue, you also had a childhood that was very sort of informed by fauna and flora, and yet not necessarily contextualizing plants of the Quran, but certainly you had this interest in nature, which you then drew on in the process of carrying out this work.
Yes, thank you for asking. I mean, I was born and brought up in West Africa, and my father was an amateur botanist and a teacher, and I used to go out collecting plants in the bush with him. And so I think, you know, right from that very early age, when you're looking for detail, attention to detail, I mean, obviously you're very tiny, but, you know, it sets the tone for, you know, for later on in life and you know, fascination for plants, a respect and interest of the plants themselves. And so I've always had plants in my life, always enjoyed, you know, looking at plants and distinguishing the differences. And as a child, I always used to love those puzzles where, you know, spot the difference between two puzzles. But I mean, that's pretty basic, spotting the difference. But, you know, it comes back to, you know, a good grounding for you and being aware of plants and being interested. And yes, so the seed for plants was sown very, very young, definitely.
Yeah, so it was quite a close connection. I mean, Sue was mostly either in Abu Dhabi or in New Zealand. And we spoke continuously because whenever she would find a particular plant, we also wanted to go to the earliest cultivars, if you would say. So in the Quran, there are 22 plants that are mentioned, fairly straightforward. 13 or 14 of them are food plants. The food plants, we all know, they are quite straightforward. Few other plants that were there, those were a little bit more difficult. But what we tried to do with Sue and myself, even for the food plants, we wanted to go to the earliest possible cultivar that we could find. So we had to do this kind of small or a little bit more research on what were the plants like. For example, garlic. It mentions in 16th century, or actually an earlier 12th century, 13th century botanist who was Maimonides. I mean, he's called Maimonides. He went to Egypt and he mentions that the garlic that was sold over there was purple, as a purplish color. So we tried to get actually garlic that was purplish in colors, which could then be drawn by Sue. And quite luckily in Oman, up in the mountains, there's very old agriculture terraces over there, and they've been cultivating garlic for a long period of time. And actually the garlic is with purple, outer covering of it is purple. So we tried to go to the earliest, well, where we could find to remain as authentic as possible to the plants that would be used 1600 years ago.
So this is quite, you know, a vast undertaking. Can you sort of tell us a little bit about the challenges, the difficulties that you both faced in trying to carry out this research?
For me, the most challenging thing was basically tracing the origins of the plants. As I said, you know, some of the plants which had names in Arabic, so there was a classical names in Arabic, and that was a straight translation I could do in English. I could find the botanical name. It's not a problem. Now, in the Quran, some of the names are only mentioned once. Kitta, for example, is only mentioned once. And it was very difficult to find what that plant was, the context in which it is written. And it is written in the context when Jonah is swallowed by the whale, and then he's thrown out of because he had displeased God. And then he is washed up on the riverbank, possibly in Iraq, either the Tigris or the Euphrates, we do not know. And he lay there, and a plant shaded him from the sun, basically. Now, I found that quite difficult, and there are lots of other different plants which say, well, this is that plant, or this is that plant. And for us to basically figure out, is it ricinus? Is it castor oil? Is it what we thought was a gourd, large leaves, which would provide some sort of shade for Jonah? So these were the most difficult ones. And another example that I can give, which created quite a bit of a challenge for me, was kafur. Mention of kafur is there in the Quran. And the mention is quite strange, because it says, indeed, the righteous will drink from a cup, and we don't know whether wine is there or not. This is the English translation. Whose mixture, and the Arabic word is mizaj, or is of camphor, kafur. So there were two plants that came into mind. Is it kafur, which is camphora, which has got a very nice smell? Or is it the color that is alluded to in the Quran? And would it then be henna? So both of these plants they were there at that time when the Quran was scribed. People knew, and the color of henna was basically the color of wine. So in this context, where there were two plants that could be there, in the Bible, kafur is henna. They say that is henna. When I started to research, I researched, and the fact that kafur, the camphor, could have been there, although a lot of people said it's a Middle Eastern, it's a plant of Far East, and there probably is no way that it could have reached Arabia or any place. But that was, I think, incorrect, because plants had moved. Plants have moved from thousands of years to this area. So as we know it, plants have moved along with trade. Way back 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 years, people, when they domesticate plants, they take them with them, and then the movement of the plants. Some of them, we do not even know the origin. Where does, for example, we know that zaytun comes from the Mediterranean area, but we do not know the exact place, because it has been cultivated and moved for such a long time that we do not know the origin of it. And that was one of the challenges that we had to do. I had to go and look at the vegetation along the banks of the rivers Euphrates and see, do these plants actually grow there? Does ricinus grow there? Does the gourd or kitta, would it grow there? And then, yes, I think they do grow there. And that was, we take that into context, but I did have to check whether or not these plants would be found over there, and they are. So, and that's why we describe it. The same was with kafur. I had to, you know, look into a lot of research, a lot of literature to say, could kafur be present down in ancient Mesopotamia, in ancient Iraq? Could it have been used as an essence? Then it would obviously be the mizaj, as we say, would be that of kafur, of camphor, rather than henna. So in this context, I have put in both the plants, because I'm not absolutely sure which is it, that the Quran is mentioning.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, with some of these very sort of evocative, but also slightly unclear sort of descriptions that were unearthed, how did you translate those into illustrations, Sue?
I think certainly with one you mentioned earlier on, one of the difficulties, and obviously for me, I live in New Zealand, and one of the difficulties was traveling to the Middle East, to Oman, up into the mountains. And as Shahina said, we tried to go back to look at crops, how they had been grown for generations. And certainly, you know, that was a very interesting journey to go back to these, you know, groups of people that were growing them as they had been done before. And in each instance, people were always very accepting, very encouraging, very generous, generosity of spirit, very enthusiastic about the project. So there was always help. You know, wherever I've been, there's always been incredible help and an interest in the project. Just to answer your question, one of the difficulties I found was with one of the plants under mana, the haloxylon in the desert. And when I first saw it, it's a pretty insignificant looking little plant. And it has sort of slightly succulent stems because it's trying to preserve water. And when I looked at it, first of all, I mean, unlike the pomegranate flowers, and you know, that's something interesting as a botanical artist, you think, well, that's going to be fun to do. But when I saw haloxylon, I thought, this is not actually going to be very interesting to do. How can I make it interesting for the, you know, for the viewer? And I could see on the stems these little tiny yellow dots. And then once I put it under the microscope, I realized that these were just tiny 1 millimeter flowers. And so blowing it up to times 25, which you can see on the illustrations, all the illustrations are very large, that, you know, suddenly there was beauty in it. Suddenly, you know, there was interest. And the wings of the fruit as well, the seeds have these little winged fruit on them. And then again, under the microscope, you know, which you're used to working as a scientific illustrator, you do dissections, you blow things up, you enlarge them. And so, you know, there was actually beauty in the plant. And I was very wrong. So in my message is, don't take things at face value. You know, look deeper. There's always beauty, you know, whether it's blown up, whether, you know, because I was looking at it from ignorance, and then getting to know the plant better, to dissect it, to take it apart, which is always all my training. So it was actually very beautiful and very interesting. And so, you know, when the illustrations are drawn bigger than life, you know, people are saying, well, you know, you're bringing out the beauty in plants, you're bringing out something that maybe not with haloxylon, people are not so familiar with it, but, you know, you're showing aspects of the plant that people are not aware of. And so that was an interesting challenge. So, you know, to make something interesting for people, for the viewer to see, as well as for myself to work on as well, obviously. Yeah.
Wonderful. I mean, I think this is really, you know, your descriptions of the research that you carried out, Shahina, and the illustrations that you created, Sue, it's really a process of, it's a testament to the process of peeling off layers and uncovering and looking closely and really seeing the beauty in the sort of small sections and what lies underneath. It's really, it's about excavating and getting to a sort of a truth or a beauty. I think what's really struck me is this, that the response to this book and to the exhibition and to this project and the research has been absolutely phenomenal. I mean, we can see it here in, you know, this sort of, you know, this packed sort of auditorium. And I really wanted to ask you whether this response surprised you at all. Were you expecting the level of interest and the level of energy and positivity that this book has sort of ignited, or were you unsure what the reception would be?
I must admit, I did not know that it would bring in a completely different sect. I mean, I was writing it when I was researching it, and it was very much a botanical book, let's put it this way. So I got interested in looking at plants, looking at their history, not just of the Quranic plants, but other through their names or through where they have come from. I mean, that is also a part of, like, the biogeography, as you may say, of the plants. And so this book was very much in that context. So the name, as it says, it's history and culture of the plants of the Quran. And when it first was launched at Kew, I was very surprised, and everybody over there was so surprised that it brought in a completely different clientele. I mean, a different set of people who came to see the exhibition and to get the book. So yes, that was very, very surprising to me. Yes, indeed.
I think what was surprising to me as well was everybody's reaction to the work and to the book. And as I said, I mean, the project has been ongoing since 2015 over a period of 8 years. And, you know, it's taken a lot of travel with, certainly with both our sides of the work. You know, there's a lot of, as you said, peeling off the layers. And so, you know, there's a lot of travel research to find the right plants, then preliminary drawings. I mean, somebody asked me how long it took me to dash a painting off. And for people, hopefully, who can get to Cartwright Hall and see, this was one of the biggest date palm paintings. And it stands over about 1.4 meters tall. And I said, dashing off is not a word you would use for botanical illustration at all. You know, it's studied. There are several layers of preliminary notes, of composition work. It's meticulous, it's detailed, it's slow. And so, you know, each of the paintings takes hundreds and hundreds of hours. So, you know, it's a very, very slow process. But sorry, to answer your question, I found everybody, apart from that comment, was how long did it take me to dash it off? Everybody's been, you know, really interested. And, you know, from whatever culture, whatever your background is, obviously it's very special to the Muslim faith. But, you know, people from other cultures have, you know, it's crossed bridges, it's crossed boundaries, and it's been accepted, you know, unilaterally, I think. And the feedback has been absolutely superb. We've had no negative feedback, you know, whatsoever, which has been incredible. And, you know, people's reaction to it, as I said, you know, generosity of spirit, really kind. So it's a very positive, it's non-political, it's non-threatening, you know, it's just the opposite. It's all-encompassing. It's beautiful. It's interesting. It's fascinating. Northern Hemisphere scientist, Southern Hemisphere artist. It combines all sorts of interesting aspects. And I think people have found that really, you know, interesting. And obviously, you know, bringing something to people's attention that hasn't actually been done before as well.
When you were first introduced to the project, to the research, did you envisage how the illustrations might look? And to what extent do they correlate with what you eventually produced? I'm really interested to know sort of what you imagined and what was produced. What was that journey?
Yeah, I think from my perspective, obviously as a botanical illustrator, you're always taught, you know, from Q and doing a degree, that you show as much of the plant as possible. So you show the habit and you show the whole flowering and fruiting stage. So you're trying to cover as much information on the plant and the dissection work as well, because it's a dissection work that, you know, gives it that accuracy and that attention to detail. And that's what we were, you know, striving to represent. I mean, apart from, you know, the accuracy of the species or the, you know, the variety that we were, you know, the ancient variety that we were talking about. So its shape, its color, its composition work. So it's showing as much information and trying to be aesthetically pleasing, because obviously you want something pleasing for people to look at. Yeah, so I always had an idea, but the paintings are actually all very large. And I think people didn't realize quite how big they are. And again, people are saying, you know, you're showing beauty, you're bringing something alive that perhaps people have read in the Quran or they're familiar with. But, you know, then when you see it in front of you, it's bringing in detail and aspects that people are not familiar with. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Beautifully, thank you. You both mentioned this concept of the plants of the Quran having a bridge building feature to it or sort of capacity. Can you speak a little more to that? You know, in what way do you think this research, these illustrations deepen our understanding of or knowledge of Islam and the era in which the Quran was revealed? And in what ways is this work able to build bridges between communities in a very sort of, you know, difficult context, which is our sort of geopolitical?
Well, I must admit, I'm not a scholar of Islam at all, and I don't... But what I liked about, you know, when I was researching this book, Quran is a very simple book. And what I learned from when looking at the plants in my research was how the plants were used actually to give a message. Nowhere specifically in the Quran it says, as far as the plants are concerned, this plant you should eat for abdominal problems, or this plant you should use for this ailment. It says for the grapes, for example, you know, they're good, eat them, be blessed. These are blessed fruits. So from what I understand, several of the plants that I mentioned are used to convey to the people, because plants were there. People knew the plants around. And I can quote one example of khardal. Khardal is mustard. And we all know why mustard is. It's the uniqueness. It's a very, very tiny seed. And I think people knew the tiny seed of mustard. And in the Quran, it says, "We shall set up scales of justice for the day of judgment, so that not a soul will be dealt with unjustly. And if there be no more than the weight of a mustard seed, we will bring into account." So the plants were used in some sort of a message or a context, which were telling the people, you know, this is a plant, this is the message it brings you. And I think that is something which I really learned, and I thought that was a beautiful thing to say. It wasn't giving instructions about how to grow this plant or how to harvest it or how to, it's always in the positive, you know, giving a message. It talks about, for example, of the pomegranate, it has got a lot of seeds. Share, you know, it's a blessed fruit. Share what you have. And probably because it's got so many seeds in there, you know, don't keep whatever that you have got, you know, don't keep the riches or whatever to yourself. Share it with others. It is a blessed fruit, and so on. So many of the plants that are there mentioned in the Quran, they have a message behind them. And that is the beauty of it, I think.
Yes.
And the mention of it.
Yes, I mean, this comes through so well in the book. Sue, can you speak to sort of any deepening of your understanding of Islam and the time in which the Quran was revealed, that this work, this journey took you upon?
Certainly from a personal perspective, I was speaking to, and talking about minute details as well, speaking to a Muslim friend of mine, Sheikha Shamila, and she was talking about the date seed and the fatil, the thread that joins the seed to the inside of the fruit, and then the kitmir that is the sheath around to stop the seed from drying out. And I thought, yes, I'm familiar with both of these. And obviously from the Quran point of view, you know, like the mustard seed, it's, you know, something so small is still relevant. And then she talked about on the seed, the nakir, the little tiny dimple. And I thought, I haven't seen this. I wasn't aware of this. And so I had to eat some more dates just to make sure and just to check them out. And sure enough, on every date has a little dimple on it. And from, you know, obviously the Muslim faith, it's a measure of, you know, something so small as the nakia, it's still relevant, it's still important, you're still judged, you know, it's to be, you know, very much aware of. And from my perspective, I thought, how had I missed something? And so, you know, talking to somebody from their faith point of view, I learned a lot more. And I also learned, you know, to look more closely, to look more carefully. I mean, I thought I had looked closely. I thought I did look at the detail. And it took, you know, two people from the different perspectives, one from her faith and myself from, you know, botanical illustration point of view, you know, looking at the finer details on these. And I had missed something so important. I mean, so important in you know, within your faith. And something botanically important, it's the point of germination. And so, you know, it's really a key aspect of this tiny little seed. It's a point of germination, and yet I had missed it. So, you know, that to me was it opened my eyes, and it was a fascinating story that I remember in talking to Shamila from her faith perspective. Yeah,
that's beautiful. I mean, that's a beautiful anecdote, and I think, you know, anyone who reads the book will really, you know, will really understand the depth of sort of, you know, accumulating knowledge that this book introduces you to through these illustrations and through the research. I have a slightly different question now, if I may, which is also sort of broadly contextualizing the book in our contemporary times. So, I mean, I think we all agree we're sort of currently facing this threat from climate crisis. And I wondered how you would locate the importance of this book, this research, these illustrations, in that narrative of the climate crisis that we're currently facing?
Well, I always say, and I've just put the slide up, which is about basically about climate change. And we all know we are facing that at a very accelerated manner in a way. And I always, it's difficult to say, I mean, in all contexts, but if you preserve culture, and I think that is quite important, when you preserve culture, you preserve a plant. I mean, I'm only talking in terms of plants. And plants grow in certain habitats. When you're preserving plants, you will preserve a habitat. And that is basically a, you know, sort of a message for conservation. It is very true, you can take date palms. I mean, one of the biggest places where they are now cultivated is California in the United States. They cultivate grape dates. But the culture that is associated with dates is only found where the date palms are native to. The same goes with quite a number of plants. Pomegranate, for example, is native to Afghanistan, Central Asian countries, Pakistan, Afghanistan area, Iran. And the culture that is associated with it, the foods that come from it, they have that pomegranate as a part of their culture. So it's so important to conserve habitats, even, of course, you know, with the climate change that we are facing. Conservation is very, very important. So preserving culture, putting it next, preserving a plant, you preserve that and you preserve a habitat.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Sue, I don't know if you wanted to add.
I suppose from my perspective, again, it would be adding that I think the research, the illustrations, you know, the exhibition, the talks, I mean, maybe not so much here, I don't think there's any children here, but certainly we were doing a workshop at Cartwright Hall and a family day. And for children to get involved, and children were also coming to the exhibition, and I'm sure, you know, the book, I know there are people who bought books for their family and for their children. And so, you know, if children are made aware, because everybody is so used to, you know, being on their phone and going flick, 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 pause, you know, what makes them pause? And if coming to, you know, to see a plant or to see an illustration or pick up a book or have a little bit more awareness, there were some children drawing some leaves and, you know, they were just, you know, drawing leaves off it. The veins off at, you know, right angles. And I said, no, we'll just have a closer look at it, you know, draw with your finger, trace it. And then suddenly we're talking about central vein and the veins going to the edges of the leaves. And so just by looking more closely and being aware, then, you know, it's passing it on to another generation of maybe stirring an interest in the plants and stirring an interest in preserving the plants or growing the plants at home or growing the plants. I know schools have, you know, programs of growing certain plants on. So it's an awareness of plants and it's an appreciation, it's a respect. And that starts with children in the home. And, you know, if it starts in reading the Quran, in reading, you know, the verses that are involved with plants, then, you know, that's sowing the seed of knowledge, of wisdom, of, you know, for the next generation. And so if that brings an awareness to help with climate change or just general awareness for children to be, you know, not just constantly on their phone, you know, what you're eating, what you're growing, what's around you. So I think maybe it's helped in a small way in that respect as well.
Absolutely. And it's a deeply accessible book as well. I mean, it's accessible, you know, to sort of, you know, all age groups. I don't know if you wanted to add anything. Oh, okay. So I mean, this is, you know, this is a beautiful book. You know, it's a phenomenal, stunning exhibition, which, you know, you really must visit if you get the chance. So I'm wondering, where will this research go next? What are your future plans with this project? Or do you see this sort of now being out in the world and sort of, you know, a process of co-creation in which people will then sort of learn and sort of, you know, acquire knowledge and deepen their understanding of plants in the Quran? What do you see as the next steps for both of you?
Well, we're very much hoping that the next step is to take it elsewhere as well. I mean, we've had an exhibition in London. Bradford is another one. We are very much hoping that it goes outside England. We are very much hoping that it goes to Saudi Arabia. There has been an offer, and the exhibition and the book possibly will be going there. As far as the book is concerned, there is a talk with publishers to have it translated so that it is available a little bit more globally, basically first in Arabic and then maybe in other languages. So that's our next step, basically. My own research, I am now concentrating a little bit more on medicinal plants, because I think just as everything is disappearing so fast, knowledge about the medicinal plants is eroding at a very fast rate. And especially in the Middle East, where they are still used, you know, they are quite respected, they're used. So my next project, in which I'm already working, is to write on the medicinal plants of the Middle East. There will be, of course, overlaps with the Quranic book as well, because some of the plants that are here in the Quran are also medicinal, and they're noted to be medicinal. And a good example, I think, is that of the toothbrush tree, or the toothbrush miswak, which, of course, we believe that Prophet Muhammad used to clean his teeth. And that is mentioned in the Quran as Raq, Raqa, Miswak, which comes as, again, one of the things. Science has told us a little bit more about this plant. It is antibacterial. They have made their research on it, on the chemistry of it, and it is antibacterial. So there is a little bit of truth. So if you brush your teeth, I mean, but it also says in the hadith, in one of the things that Prophet Muhammad said, do not brush it too hard. Otherwise, your enamel would come off, you know, of your teeth. So be careful when you're actually brushing it with. But there is a bit of truth that it takes away the bacteria in there. So that's another aspect that I think is really worth looking at. Some of it will be covered in my book, which is on medicinal plants of the Middle East. And yeah, so that's the next project for me.
It's very exciting. But, look forward to that soon.
Very exciting indeed, yes. I have a couple of projects, that most one in particular around education, and I'm just waiting to see, hopefully in the next couple of weeks, if it'll go across the line and be accepted to continue, because it will be very exciting in terms of education, and it's actually taking the date palm and taking dissection aspects of male and female plants and blowing them up to 2 meters tall, and then going deeper into electron microscope work and looking at the pollen grain and looking at patterns on the pollen grain and creating an exhibition around the dates and around pollen. So again, it's peeling back the layers, but going even deeper. And so it will involve movement and displays that are supposed to, or I hope, will captivate people. And so, you know, they'll be aware of male and female flowers on the date palm, but then will you be aware of, you know, the tiny pollen grain and what it looks like? And so recreating that as a pattern and maybe on the floor, and people, you know, it's something to think about more deeply and, you know, for children to be more aware of as well. So it's going into the educational side of things. So inshallah, it will go ahead. I hope to hear in the next couple of weeks. So we'll see. But it's the message of education and engaging children, which, I mean, obviously adults as well, but, you know, going much deeper and into detail.
Inshallah. Yeah. So I have been satisfying my own curiosities with my own questions, but now I think it's time to open up questions to our audience. We have a question, the lady in the front.
Hello, Susan. It's good to have you all here today. Actually, yesterday I went to the exhibition. The exhibition is free, but this is here is not is a ticket event. So as I know that this festival is sold out. So yeah, it's quite inspiring what you talk about. It's quite saying that. So the exhibition is free. So whoever would like to go, more welcome to go and see the exhibition. So this is a ticket event. So you have visited another country. And explaining what each vegetable or fruit is?
Sorry, with regard to the exhibition is on until the 8th of September. Yes, at Cartwright Hall.
Yeah, it's free.
It is free for everybody to go, and it's open every day apart from Monday. They're not open on a Monday, but every other day it's open. And yes, it is definitely free for everybody to go and see. So I'm sorry, I don't quite understand the question.
Does that answer your question? Were you wondering if the exhibition will be travelling elsewhere, or how long it will be on in Cartwright Hall? Is
right.
That?
Yeah. I went to Cartwright Hall, so this exhibition's free. So I saw I saw your exhibition, and so it's quite.
Did you enjoy it? Good. I'm pleased. Thank you very much.
I would like to go see the exhibition.
Thank you very much for your question. Thank you. A lady at the front there.
When you were traveling to do your research, what was your response from the different people when you told them that you were researching the plants and you were there to work on this project?
Oh, very helpful. Extremely, extremely helpful. And I think I had to do a lot of research, but just looking at the names, and especially the names, and these some of them were quite difficult. So I had friends and scholars from SOAS, from the School of African and Asian Studies in London. They were sort of, you know, I mean, they were middle, they spoke middle Persian. And of course, you know, I don't know. So they helped me to understand some of the names and what their origin could be. This was when tracing back the origin of the plants many times I looked at the etymology, the name of the plant. Ruman, for example, I mean, in Arabic it is Ruman, but in the area where pomegranates grow, it's called Anar. In Urdu, it's called Anar. In Kazakhstan and all the Central Asian countries, it's called Anor, but basically Anar. And I was wondering, you know, where did Rimmon or that came from? So there was Middle Persian, from what I understand. Can I go on? I mean, is this, we have some time. So there's a Middle Persian name, which is now lost, which was used in Sogdian, in the area which was between Afghanistan and China, you know, this the area. And nobody knows what happened to it because the language was lost. The Sogdian language was lost. But that name, somehow, the Anar got translated into Rimmon. And Rimmon, R-R-M-N, is the root for Ruman. That came to be the why in Arabic it is called Ruman. So it was just this sort of investigations. And people were always very helpful. I mean, I have friends, of course, a lot of the names or the old Arabic names, they are, you can trace their origins in Aramaic. And Aramaic is a language which is very close to Jewish, the Jewish language. So I did have to go to some of the scholars in the Academy of Sciences in Jerusalem. Very helpful. They gave me what they were. So, I mean, amongst scholars, I would say it was completely open how they would help me to investigate any name that I was looking at or any other information which I was doubtful for. Yeah.
I'm a student of ecology and conservation biology, and one of the things that has been brought up quite a lot in my studies is the use of the Latin binomial namings for species being quite a Eurocentric way of classifying things, especially because a lot of things were not discovered by the, like, discovered in quotation marks by the Europeans. And I was wondering if a lot of the species that you identified probably didn't have an originally Latin name, or if they did, perhaps it was difficult to find it. And maybe keeping, like, I want to know, like, what your ideas about keeping the Arabic name was, or like what species you, like, whether you would call it a species using the Linnaean way of classifying things, or if you would keep, like, you know, have the Quranic name instead.
That's another excellent question.
I mean, the names of the plants change. They even change by locality. Even in the same country, they're known by different names. So what Linnaeus did was to formalize it. So pomegranate is Punica granatum. It's Punica granatum, its botanical name, and it is known by that name all over the world, by its botanical name. So I had to, of course, you know, I mean, I was writing this book, and it's a book that I cannot use all the vernacular names. It gives, I mean, I think I've given all the vernacular names which are relevant at the beginning of each description of plant. But these are the names which are spoken in Turkey or in parts of Pakistan or Afghanistan. It depends upon where the plant is coming from. But the Quranic names, of course, stays, because that is what is mentioned in the Quran, and the book is about those names. But the botanical name is constant, let's put it this way. So yeah, we have to use the botanical names to make a stand. It's a standardization.
Did that answer your question, or
was it possible to find the Latin name for every species, is kind of what I was asking, because that is a modern way of, like, using, calling all species that maybe weren't described to science back then.
Would it be possible to find?
Like, did you find the exact species of everything with the Latin name?
Absolutely. So, as a botanist, I know that there are something like 400,000 plants, and each plant has a name. Of course, you know, some people discover new species, but we are required to give it a Latin name. It may be known by its own common name, or a vernacular, wherever that plant is found. But yeah, I was able to find a Latin name for each one, and that is given in the book, yes. Yeah,
I think also with a lot of the plants in the Quran, they also cross over into other cultures as well, and there are plants that are quite common, whether they're food plants or medicinal or, you know, cultural plants like henna. So it's a group of plants that I think, if you agree, Shahina, is quite common to, you know, found in the Bible, and you go into, you know, where the plants are also, which manuscripts are also found in as well. So I don't think it was, you know, that difficult. There was nothing sort of particularly unusual. I mean, some, you know, some discussion about cedar or cedar of Lebanon, when depending on which country it's found in, whether it's Cedrus Lebani, the big cedar of Lebanon tree, or whether cedar is Zizipus spina Christi. And so there are two plants there that could be either or, you know, either of them, according to which country you're in and perhaps which scholar as well. So we show both. And that's what we've tried to show in the book. And, you know, with figs, we're trying to pick figs from, well, obviously fig is a species, but then trying to pick figs from, you know, different varieties of figs from different countries as well, to try and show, you know, other people's figs, whether Palestinian or Syrian or Lebanon. I mean, we couldn't cover all the varieties, but, you know, to give an example, it's not just one, it's a variety, again, for whichever country you're from.
Thank you. I hope that answers your question. And we have a hand up. Oh, a few hands up now. We have 5 minutes left and all the hands are going up. But there was a gentleman just to the right.
Thank you for the talk. I wanted to ask, on your field trips, the communities that you were visiting and speaking with, whether sort of, you know, any traditional indigenous knowledge systems that they were maintaining, practices that they had that were surprising to you as sort of a Western educated scientist, or, you know, maybe a keen gardener, but, you know, things that you thought, oh, wow, that's amazing, I actually want to bring that back, or even I need to somehow preserve this in the work that I'm doing.
Certainly from my perspective, visiting the remote areas in Oman and seeing the fallage system, the watering system that's been used in certain areas for a couple of thousand years. And it brings the water down from the mountains in stone trenches. And what I found absolutely fascinating was, you know, it's bringing the water into the communities, into whether it's the olive groves or the pomegranate groves. And each person, it's all siphoned off, and each person has an allotted time of water. And I thought, it's a system that's been going on for so many generations, so many years of cooperation between the farmers, between the societies. And I thought, you know, they're all sharing the same water. It's all coming off the mountains. And there was a system for blocking it off with little rocks. And then the rocks would be opened up to take a certain amount of time according to how much space you had into your land, and then blocked off again and taken on to the next one. And I found that fascinating, you know, example of incredible cooperation to a resource that was so precious, and yet it would have been going on for, you know, for generations. So I don't know if that answers your question, but, you know, from my perspective, seeing that for the first time was fascinating, absolutely.
Yeah, well, yeah, I think I would just say the same.
Okay. There's a question with the lady in the black.
Hi, I'm really excited to read the upcoming work that you have on medicinal plants. And just for some context, I'm starting to study the medicinal function because I'm studying traditional Islamic medicine. And I was wondering, how do you actually start to get the plant to reveal its real function and purpose to you? I know that you can study by reading the chart, where it grows, what it's used for, the plants that it grows next to, that kind of thing. But I'm thinking more on a spiritual level. Do you sit with the plants? Do you meditate with the plant? I know that sounds really strange, but how do you, on a different level, get to know the plant and form a relationship with it so that it reveals itself to you?
There is obviously, I mean, in Islam, there are aspects. I mean, we do believe not really magic or jinn or something, but there are plants which are used in more of a spiritual, I would say. And one of them is quite common in the desert, which is called the Rose of Jericho. It looks like when it is folded up, when it's dried, it looks like a hand. It basically looks exactly like that. It's very small, grows on sand. It is believed, people believe, that this, and they call it Kaf al Maryam, you know, the fist of Maryam. And they believe that when Jesus was being born, Mary clutched some foliage to take away the pain or whatever, and this was one of them. It was a plant, and it sort of, you know, looks like a hand. A lot of people will soak that, I mean, out in the villages, and even, well, some traditional people, they soak the plant in water, and just to ease childbirth, and they will give it to the mothers just to ease. As far as we know, I mean, obviously, you know, when you have such plants, you look at their analysis, you see what they're like, you know, is there anything, any sort of factor in it which is beneficial? To my mind or to my knowledge, it isn't. I mean, it is just the belief of people that if you hold this plant or if you make a little infusion out of it and you drink it, it will be good for you. There are many other plants in the same manner. I mean, the things that are like, for example, this is used as a tonic. It's good for you. It may be beneficial or not, but it's a tonic. It's good for you. So people who are ill, they will be given that a portion of that plant or made an infusion of that. Whether it is actually chemically good or not, we do not know. I mean, at least I have not done that kind of thing, but it's the belief of the people. And I think that's quite important to believe in something. It doesn't matter if it's not good for you, as long as it's not bad for you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Shahina. And thank you, Sue. I know that there were some more hands up and I really do apologize, but it's 5:30 and we're out of time, I do believe. Thank you to our wonderful speakers. Thank you for the excellent questions.
Thank you, Samia. Thank you very much. And thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast, presented by Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival on Friday the 27th of June to Sunday the 6th of July 2025.